Bishop Hunt, we have saved a seat for you on the front row. And I will gladly wait while you parade down the aisle.
I was coming anyway.
You don't think I'd miss a chance like that. Somebody said the other day of a bishop, he used to be my brother in Christ, now he's my father in God. I fondly aspire to the hope that there are some bishops who are both. Thank you. I am particularly burdened this morning with the fact that you have to, those of you who are long-suffering, to endure me twice on this platform. I want to say two or three preliminary things. The first is how indescribably good it is to come around the corner and meet various of you, some old, tired faces that I've known for a long time, and some of you who are under 35 and are our hope. I am reminded of the young man who wrote his lover a letter. They had been separated, and he said, "I am so miserable without you, it's almost like you're here." But I want you to know it isn't misery. I want you to know the greatness of my year in Fort Lauderdale was not me. It was the pastors who would put up with me. When it was first proposed that I go, I was to be called a theologian in residence, which was a real ha-ha because biblical students almost never make good theologians. There's another half to that statement, but we are Christians and I will restrain. And then somebody said, could he be the teacher in residence, which suggests that the others weren't teachers. And that was no good. So a pure genius on the committee arrived at the thought that I might be called a pastor. Which meant, of course, that Ralph and Larry could get me to do anything they didn't want to do. But that wasn't the way it turned out. And it was one second item of introductory business. Do we have to have, and this is not rudeness, titles? I am not Dr. Beck. And if ever I come to your church, please do not pray for Dr. Beck. God does not know Dr. Beck. God knows names like Elizabeth and George and Harold. How's that for arrogance? Just the Queen and me, all right? A few years ago, the United Methodists mounted a great missional campaign and had the World Council meeting on the beach at Waikiki. The bishops wanted to have a good time. They got a lackey to do the morning devotions, and I enjoyed most of that. But it meant that for five mornings in a row, 3,500 Methodists had to open one eye and make a fateful decision. Beach, bed, or Beck. The second morning I was stopped in the lobby of the Sheraton Waikiki by a French woman who claimed to be a Methodist and she was from Paris. I didn't quite trust that biography. Now some of you are stopped frequently in hotel lobbies by various and assorted people. I, who am almost never stopped by a woman from Paris in a hotel lobby. was asked, do you have a minute? And in sheer exuberation, I said, I've got as long as you want. She sat down and she said, there's a woman here from South Africa who's really mad at you. And I said, whatever for? And she said, I asked her that after your lecture yesterday morning, and she invited me to tea, and we hadn't sat down until she looked me straight in the eye, the woman from South Africa, and said to the woman from Paris, in our country, our ministers do not speak about our public problems from our pulpits. I said to the woman from Paris, what did you say? I will never forget her answer. She said, I looked her straight in the eye, and I said, in your country, your ministers do not speak about your problems from your pulpits, but in our country, our ministers speak about your problems from our pulpits. And of course she was not entirely right, because there are the Tutus in South Africa for whom our prayers surely before these conferences are over. We live in a world that does have to pay attention to its problems. And it ought to do more seriously so. For years I was troubled with that biblical text, Isaiah chapter 3, verse 10. It has pleased the Lord to bruise the servant. I thought a savvy editor could have saved us from that. It's interesting to muse on what editors did save us from in the Bible, including, I'm quite sure, some of the statements of Jesus. But I've grown up to know that that text is one of the most precious things, Dan, we've got in the whole of Isaiah. It pleases the Lord to take a few human beings and sandpaper the cockles of their hearts until they could not walk by brutality and injustice. It pleases the Lord to bruise the servants, because then they begin to amount to something. Ernie Campbell, that wonderful peripatetic preacher, has a sermon, have you read it? Did Jesus cry? In the church, we've not wanted Jesus to cry. The cattle are lowing, the poor baby wakes, but the little Lord Jesus, no crying he makes. A stiff upper lip at an early age. Good heavens, you'd think those swaddling clothes were Pampers, wouldn't you? I'll bet you those old rags itched. Says Ernie Campbell, wouldn't it be ironic if we believed that Jesus didn't cry when he was a baby, because the Gospels say he cried when he was a man. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, I would have, but you would not. I had a call one day, and I answered, and the man on the other end of the line said, this is Norman Vincent Peale. I'm name-dropping, did you notice? I said, yes, Dr. Peale, I'm pleased to hear from you. He said, I have an important question. I said, what is it? He said, I'm doing a jacket for one of my children's books, and I want to know, were there chickens in the Bible? That's a big theological question. I said, which kind did you mean? That was a wasted question. And quick as a bunny, I, whose mind can go blank when somebody asks me a question about the Bible, I hate Bible trivia questions. Quick as a bunny, I said, well, Jesus said, oh, Jerusalem, I would have gathered you as a hen gathers her chickens. And I heard on the other end of the wire, like, why didn't I think of that? I believe Jesus cried. I think he also laughed. Someplace else, Ernie Campbell says, the most beautiful thing about the story of Jesus at the wedding in Cana of Galilee is that he was having such a good time, he stayed until they ran out of refreshments. I love it. Now, Methodists may have a little problem with the fact that he made barrels of Mogan David as a solution. But one of my friends in Illinois, who remakes Jesus as a Methodist, says, of course, there is no such thing as alcoholic wine in Jesus' life. I leave that to you. Feeling, it's important. But you know you can't feel if you don't first admit you're a human being. A few years ago, Lila and I were in Australia, and one evening we sat with Robert Menzies, who is the lead tenor of the Australian Opera Company. I said, how did you ever become an opera singer? I'm interested in how people became opera singers and salesmen for suspension bridges and clergy. You know, the way out things. He said, I couldn't do anything else. I said, you're kidding. He said, you should have seen my mathematics course in engineering school. He said, when I took the final exam in geometry, I was stunned by the questions. I sat for 20 minutes and finally I folded the blue book shut and I wrote across it, God knows all the answers, Robert Menzies. The next day I got the book back. Miracle, a blue book had turned red. And the instructor had written across it, God, 100%, Menzies, zero. You hear me, don't you? You hear me? It is one of the ironic facts, and please take it seriously, be you from Boston, Princeton, Asbury, Emory. Of course I say the best to last, you know. Be it understood very clearly that the historic Christian church has had a lot more trouble accepting the humanity of Jesus than it ever has his divinity. And so I want to launch today, and I must stop at 9:20 or 9:25 or I'll never be allowed back. I want to launch out today on the wisdom tradition. A breed of people who, in my judgment, took human life so seriously, knew that generally speaking the pronouncements of councils, ecumenical and otherwise, are several meters back of the cutting edge of the church. And took humanity seriously enough that they held with one hand on the creeds of the church, never letting them become creedalism. But on the other hand, reached out in love with people who are facing questions to which the church had not yet formulated answers. In the beginning was wisdom, the mind of God, the redeeming word. No wonder Paul uses the words interchangeably, wisdom, word, Christ. And then at 11 o'clock, if anybody survives, I want to talk about the greatest of the wisdom books, and that is Job. Could I put it this way, please? 1957. You don't need any notes on this. I'll tell you when you need notes. Enjoy. Remember Plato said, don't write down what I say. That's the way you kill it. How many of you have learned that from seminary? 1957, death came to a Greek poet in a miserable little rooming house in Freiburg, Germany. So poor that his widow hitchhiked to Paris. Don't let me get lost, please. So poor that his widow hitchhiked to Paris to beg money to take his body back to his native Crete for burial next to his revolutionary grandfather. While she was gone, a cable came. I hear your husband is seriously ill. I would like to send my private airplane to take him back so that he may die in his native Crete. May I? Sincerely yours, Aristotle Onassis. Only proves there's some good in the best of us. She didn't get the cable for years. She came back from Paris, rented a horse and an ambulance, and hired two German ambulance drivers and rode in the back of the ambulance from Freiburg, Germany to Athens, Greece, with her husband's body. His name was Nikos Katsantzakis. They were met there by the local version of the CIA to be told you cannot bring the body of a heretic into the holy city. Knew the way around the airport, which some of you do. The Athens airport is outside the city on the east side. And there, waiting on the apron of the airfield, pilot laid on, was the private airplane of Aristotle Onassis. The Archbishop of Athens issued a decree that no priest of the archdiocese should say Mass over the body of Nikos Kanon. But when they finally got to Heraklion in Crete, some brother priest broke the law of the church. I say it with great care. And the day they had a funeral for Nikos Katsantzakis, 50,000 Greek students carried his books in front of his corpse. How's that? They buried him high on the Venetian citadel up on a wall at the edge of Heraklion, and they put a 12-foot wooden cross over his grave. The town fathers were infuriated. They ordered that the place should become a pissoir, which is the French version of what Puritans don't say in English, the town toilet. And for 10 years it stunk from April until November. Finally, Helen Katsantzakis said, either you clean up this place or I exhume my husband's body. You know, he had lost the Nobel Prize for Literature by one vote to Albert Camus that year. The night Camus got it, he sent a cable to Katsantzakis saying, we both know who should have had it. Wow. Helen Katsantzakis said, you clean up the place or we exhume my husband's body and take him to Spain, Mallorca, France, West Germany, Italy, all of which have asked to have the honor of being his burial place. They cleaned it up. And I gotta go see it. I haven't been there. I want to go. What was his crime? This young Cretan who was carrying a gun at 5 because there was fascism in his land? This boy who went to Athens and was so taken with Bergsonian philosophy that he went on to Paris to study under the great master and did a PhD in philosophy? This boy who cared so much about the poverty of Greece that he went first of all to Moscow where he was disillusioned, then to Peking where he had no freedom, back to Athens to write travel folders for 15 years. Am I wasting your time? This young man who in the full maturity of his manhood suddenly had a vision which emanated in a book called The Last Temptation of Christ. This young man who portrayed Jesus as a human being, who on the cross felt pain, you know? Just as the Mother Mary is never supposed to get old, so Jesus is never supposed to have felt pain. This beautiful elder brother of ours who dreamed on the cross of how he might have married and had babies, and somebody said, what do you want to do, portray Jesus as a coward? No! But I want to portray Jesus, not as an automaton either. Even I could have been a Messiah if it had been automated. I want to portray him as a person who is tempted to say no to God so that his yes has some vital meaning. This Katsantzakis wrote The Last Temptation of Christ, and for that book, he was excommunicated from the Greek Orthodox Church, exiled permanently from Greece, and put on the then-existent literary index of the Roman Catholic Church. Oh, forgive me if I indulge in something that I have to say. Because I'd like to say that Jesus seems to have believed, with many other biblical people, the spirit of man and woman is the candle of the Lord. I'd like to say that until we can accept the humanity of Jesus, we cannot accept our own humanity. Are you with me? I'd like to say until we see the humanity of Jesus, we will not ever see the humanity of God. Even Karl Barth came around to that, didn't he? I'd like to say, am I losing you, that until we accept the humanity of Jesus, we cannot have the dazzling doctrine of his divinity. Please, I'm not a theologian. It shows, I know. If there is to be a continuity between his vocation and ours, there must be a continuity between his nature and ours. And so I want to deal with the wisdom tradition, which in my judgment takes our humanity seriously. Well, let's get down to definition. The honeymoon is over. No, I'd like to sell this bill of goods. I'd like to say that in times of crisis, by God's grace, certain artists, certain authors, come forward and restore hope in a troubled time. The wisdom tradition as old as the hills was reborn in the Babylonian exile
You say God by his grace sends messengers. May I give you an illustration? Anybody here remember when we were singing, "Will the lights come on again all over the world?" Yeah. It was touch and go, wasn't it? And I believe with all my heart, I do, that God sent Albert Camus to revive the ancient myth of Sisyphus. When you want to know where you're going, you got to ask where you've been. And to say, you know, we don't always know why we roll the rocks up the hill, but it's better to keep on rolling. I believe with all my heart that God stuck his hand into the Library of Congress and said to Archibald MacLeish, "My people haven't been reading Job lately. Rewrite it. Put it on the stage in Broadway. Call it J.B." Still better in the library than it is on the stage, but it's pretty good. I believe with all my heart that God took my colleague Elie Wiesel out of a Holocaust where he'd seen the death of his father and said, "Tell the tales of the Hasidim again." Are you with me? I believe those kinds of things. I believe with all my heart that God took Nikos Katsenzakis and said, "We're still in search of the golden fleece. Rewrite Ulysses in a modern idiom," and I see Katsenzakis almost in biblical tone rewriting Ulysses in 33,333 lines of contemporary Greek poetry. Oh, I hope you're not turned off. I want to hear this. I thank God that in the biblical tradition, when the Babylonians came and knocked the beans out of the people in Jerusalem and carried men, women, and children 1,000 miles away, and some ancient Hebraic fathers in God and mothers sat around a Babylonian campfire in about 585 B.C. and somebody said, "How shall we sing the songs of the Lord in a foreign land?" Isn't it interesting? That's just exactly where you need most to sing them. How shall you sing the songs of the Lord in a foreign land? What do you do when Marduk has won over Yahweh? This is election. This is to be the chosen people. Got no temple, got no priesthood, got no rights, got no home, whatever, got nothing. And one evening in Babylon in 585, O class, I know because I was there. I was a Jew for 1,000 years. What were you? I was a Catholic for 1,500. Oh, how Protestants resent that. They'd rather be hanging by their tails from trees in Scandinavia. Lord have mercy. Lately I've been a Protestant. Nobody's quite sure what that means. But by the grace, so they were sitting around a campfire. Got no temple, got no home, got no rights, got no priesthood. What does it mean to be a Jew? Do I tell it right, Dan? I hope so. And off in the corner of the ember sat a weazened up little prune, smoking a hubbly bubbly pipe, I think. I don't know what his addiction was. Everybody's got at least one. It's the only way you keep your neurosis from turning into a psychosis sometimes. No, I don't mean to be careless, but sat this little guy by the campfire, and they said, "What does it mean to be a Jew?" And this little guy, what nerve he had, began to sing. And he sang the most beautiful word next to the name of God in all of Hebrew. May I sing it? What chutzpah is this? That's not what he sang. This is what he sang. Torah, Torah, Torah. They said, "What are you? What do you mean, boy?" He said, "Bring the law together. Bring those prophets we never paid any attention to together. So now I'm the only Jew in Lakeland. How do I know I'm a Jew? Got Torah. Want to make something of it?" class, do you hear me? Please. And then somebody else said, Torah, that's great. Prophets, Alfred Lucker-Cuvier used to call the prophets the twice-stoned men. They were stoned to death when they preached, and 200 years later they were given a memorial stone. I love it. But then there was a bunch of characters in the crowd who said, but there are questions now that we didn't ask when everything was comfortable in Jerusalem. You see, class, I'm evangelizing for wisdom people in the 21st century. And in that crowd, there were people who said, why do the innocent weep? Why do the great suffer? And somebody else spoke up and said, well, Deuteronomy says you deserve what you get, and you get what you deserve. And Job said, don't try to sell me that bill of goods. And somebody said, maybe the way back is by sacrifice, sacrifice, sacrifice. And somebody else said, I've lived long enough to be pretty sure that prayer is even more important. Oh, dear. And somebody else said, when we get out of this Babylonian hole, we're going to divorce any wife we took from here and abandon our children. His name was Ezra. And another woman on the committee spoke up and said, the only good Gentile is a dead one. Her name was Esther, and she meant it. The funniest thing in the world was when the Methodist Church used to have a Queen Esther Society. Some of them were. And over came Jonah, and he said, just a minute, Esther. Keep it down. I'd go even to Nineveh. And Esther said, what's the matter? Are you crazy? Do you hear what I'm saying, class? I would like to stay on Thursday if either you or I survives long enough that someday Brother Charles is going to be proven right when he says that the great trend of biblical study in the next century is going to be to take carefully the shape of the canon. Well, of course, a thing that Amos preached in 750 was meaningful. But what did it mean when 550 years later somebody says it still has meaning? And what will you do with the fact? What will you do with the fact that this wisdom tradition, which I think lasted down into the early Christian period, was responsible for providing an Old Testament which is a magnificent teaching document? And when the committee got together to put the Old Testament together, finally, am I losing you? The wise ones had some say. And somebody said, we've got to have Deuteronomy in there. And there are times when we ought to preach Deuteronomy. For all input, there's an outcome, so watch it. And some other character said, you can have Deuteronomy if we can have Job. So sweat, interpreters, sweat. And somebody else said, I want Esther in there. I'm sick of these foreigners. And Jonah said, you can have Esther if you will let me and Ruth go in too. Are you with me? And somebody else says, Leviticus, we're a liturgical people, sacrifice upon sacrifice upon sacrifice. I'm losing my equipment, excuse me. There are those who think I did that a long time ago. And somebody else said, okay, take Leviticus. But can we have the Psalms, 150 liturgical poems, which never once put fire to sacrifice? Are you there? I don't want to be troublesome. I'd like to suggest that these wisdom people are pretty important. Not because they always had the neat answers, but because they honored the questions that were necessary before you could have anything like reliable answers. The Pharisees said early in those times, we can't date their origins, life after death. The Sadducees said, you say that, we'll kill you. Try it. And there it stands. Ecclesiastes says when you die, they dump you on the town dump, right next to the donkey. Daniel says, they that die shall be raised again. Have we missed the boat? Have we seen that this is a great teaching book, not primarily a book of dogma? Are we able to see that the wisdom tradition says you gotta make up your own mind on key issues? You cannot be told in maturity what to believe. Oh, there must be a chance for discussion afterwards. I'd like to do two things. Incidentally, I want to say that I think Jesus was very much in the wisdom tradition. I want to tell you, I think, am I mistaken? I think the reason for saying that is that when they put a poem in the New Testament to say, we've got to have the best of the ancient tradition, Israelite and universal, come and bow down at Bethlehem, what did they pick? Three lawyers?
No.
Three prophets? No. The Magi, if you please, sages from across the world. I don't care whether they ever got there. I don't care whether they came on single or double-humped flea bags. What I care is that the symbolism is there, because I follow one who was very much in the wisdom tradition, whose beatitudes begin with the word blessed, which is a wisdom word. Isn't it interesting that the Bible begins with a wisdom document, Genesis chapter 1, that the Psalms begin with a wisdom document, Psalm 1, that the first word of Jesus in his official teaching is a wisdom word, blessed, blessed, the beatitudes. Is that why the disciples called Jesus Rabbi, teacher? Is that where he got the nerve to set forth 70% of his teaching in fiction? Is that why we will forevermore call him the wisdom of the ages? Before these sessions are over, I warn you, I'm going to lift up three passages that show that the wisdom tradition is more responsibly moving toward a theology of Messiah than anything else in the Old Testament. I'd like to do two more things before I'm decent enough to quit. One, and now you may want to take notes. I don't know. Use your own judgment. You are wise. I want to say six things in an attempt to define wisdom. In case anybody missed it, I'm talking about things like Genesis chapter 1. What in heaven's name have we got a second creation story for? We already had a perfectly good one. Is von Raab right in saying Genesis 1 is a commentary on Genesis 2? You torment too, 500 years later, sitting on a sand pile in Babylon. I'm talking about Proverbs. I'm talking about the Song of Songs. Not as long as Marvin Pope does, but, you know, anybody who writes 1,000 pages on the Song of Songs is neurotic. Blessed be he, but what do you expect from a Methodist at Yale? In any case, I'm talking about the book of Job. I'm talking about Ecclesiastes. And I'm talking about the wisdom of Solomon, an intertestamental book that absolutely belongs in the Bible of the Christian world. Definition. Are you bored stiff? Please. It's impudence for a colleague to stand in front of 400 colleagues and think that he has enough to say to last for 40 minutes. Number one, wisdom is a skill. Wisdom is a skill. You say, how mundane. I say, have you got a 30-year-old kid who hasn't yet decided what he's going to do? Wisdom is a skill. Can you do anything? You know, people keep asking me, are your kids ministers? And I keep saying no. Well, I wish they were, but they aren't. My key question isn't, did my kids fall in my tracks? My key question is, are my kids doing something that will give them mental health because they're pulling their weight with their generation? I care about that. Wisdom is a skill. Number two, I can move fast if I have to. Wisdom is interpreting daily experience. Oh, wow. Write that one big, would you please, if you're writing things at all. Wisdom is interpreting. Do you ever get up on Monday morning and say, I think I've been here before? It didn't go so well last week. I wonder what's going to happen this week. Ever notice how you preach an absolutely brilliant sermon, You know it was. You go home and the linen is lovely and the crystal is shiny and the lunch is absolutely superb. And right in the middle of the dessert, you remember what happens? Good heavens, I've got to preach again next Sunday. It can get you down if you don't hold up. Please, wisdom is interpreting daily experience. I believe it. Number three. Class, wisdom is the search for justice. That's the big one I want to say. Wisdom is the search for justice. If you think I'm launching out into some kind of philosophical reverie, you're wrong. I'll tell you why I will be able to say by Thursday or Friday after you've all gone, I'm still up here. I will tell you why it's in the wisdom tradition that you begin to get intimations of life after death, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Nothing separate me from God's love. It is because the wisdom tradition, watch it, class, honest enough to know that justice is not being done on earth, couldn't dream of a God who didn't ultimately do justice, and therefore said, someday. That's a lot nobler than working out a doctrine of life after death because you're interested in your own skin, isn't it? Wisdom is the search for justice. I could dawdle on that. John the 23rd, whom I loved because he was wider than he was high, and it gave me great comfort. John the 23rd, you know, they had two surpluses together to get all the way around his holiness. I love it. Oh, marvelous person. Every inch a pope. In nomine patri et filii spiritus sancti. Then when he had done his popely duty, he would reach out to the audience and go like this. I can live with a pope like that. John 23rd said shortly after he's elected, he used to wake up in the middle of the night and say, that's a terrible problem. I must remember to mention it to the pope. And then all of a sudden he would jerk awake and say, good heavens, I am the pope. Lay men and women took that attitude, the search for justice in post-exilic Judaism. Number four, wisdom is asking the questions. I wonder why I stutter. Wisdom is asking the questions which often cannot be answered. Why am I gay? Says a friend of mine. Why are there AIDS in the world? Why disease? In that little town where I live and the train goes through once a week, how did Uncle Louie time it so well that he was there just when the train went through? It's the most efficient thing he ever did in his life. Asking the questions for which there are no answers. I think Monsignor Sheen was right when he said, the questions of God may ultimately be more productive than the neat little answers of men and women. I've rewritten the 23rd Psalm. Is it all right? It was pretty good before, but watch it now. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. I've rewritten it. Because I have walked through the valley of the shadow of death, I won't be afraid because I've discovered what my resources are. I can't come back with a glib little answer. Wisdom is asking the questions. I think Goethe was right when he said, you have not lived until you have asked the question of theodicy, of the whys, and the innocent suffering, and the beautiful being beaten. Class, hear me please, will you? That's important to me. Wisdom is the search for new Torah. I want to say that. Wisdom is the search for new Torah. It is unbiblical to have such a lust for certitude that you think the Holy Spirit has said all that needs to be said. That is not the Bible's view of itself. I give you the Holy Spirit. My Lord Jesus says 5 times in 2 chapters of John 14 to 16, I give you the Spirit, I give you the Spirit, I give you the Spirit. There's more to be taught, learned, discovered, understood, appreciated, lived by. Wisdom says there is such a thing as a new Torah. Otherwise we'll become a museum. And we will not make sense to people under 20 who may be more conscious of international circumstances now than many of us over 40 are. I'm running down, please. I've got to get this last one in your notes. I wish somebody had taught me this earlier on. Wisdom is understanding that faith and agnosticism are corollaries, not enemies. Please, class, let me say it again just in case you didn't want to hear it. Wisdom understands that faith and affirmative agnosticism are corollaries, not inimical. I believe, help thou mine unbelief. I know enough to know that there's a difference between the infinite mind and my little pea-thick and finite mind. God, let me have more light. Some of you may say, what else is new? And I'd like to say that the major single reason why, in my judgment, literally millions of college kids are paying very little attention to the church is that they have not yet discovered that it is possible for a Christian to be committed and open. A commitment to Jesus Christ in a healthy sense of the word doesn't mean you're closed out on all the relevant theological data. That it's just possible that a Zen Buddhist knows some more about meditation than historic Christian doctrine. That Judaism has a sense of social community of which we would well be jealous. That Islam has something to say about religion as a way of life. And Islam, which, however class conscious, has never allowed racial consciousness to destroy the religious establishment. Oh dear God, help me to see that faith and affirmative agnosticism is the way of learning. I gotta stop. I've missed several good opportunities. But please, may I have 5 more minutes? I should turn to you rather than her. For a couple of reasons. Now, class, come walk with me, will you, please? Look at Genesis chapter 1. Well, I happen to like Genesis 2, and Phyllis Tribble will help you read it in a civilized way. But I also like Genesis chapter 1. This guy who wrote Genesis 1, I think he was the guy who sat around the campfire. Because the next week, the camel caravan came through, and there was another clay tablet. And it said to him, you were so big on Torah, write the first chapter. And they said, who, me? How'd you like to be assigned to write the first chapter of Holy Torah? Well, like Paul, he didn't know what he was doing at that point, so it was all right. Hear me. And he said, what should it be about? And they said, well, creation, of course. Where do you start? And he said, well, you know, we've got a very good creation story written down in Hebron by a fellow by the name of Jay. What do you want another one for? And they said, a lot has happened. And a guy sitting next to him by the name of Ephraim von Rad or something like that, said, comment on Genesis 2. So he did. And this is the guy who had walked 1,000 miles across the desert with women and kids and camels. He knew who got up in the morning to make the porridge. He knew who washed the diapers in sand. He knew who staked the camel. He wasn't about to say, this woman without whom we couldn't have made it. Second class. And God said, let us make man in our own image. In the image of God made he him. Male and female made he them. And forever after, we can talk about the creativity of God, and we can talk about the womb of God, and we can talk about the bosom of Abraham. And that's wisdom. And Genesis 1 is right exactly where it belongs. And any kid over 5 can begin to understand it. And that's great literature. Please. Somebody else said, we've got to collect the sayings. We'll call it Proverbs. Somebody here says, I've read all the Proverbs in one sitting. I'll say, you're dull on both ends. But if somebody said, I've never read Proverbs, I will say, shame on you. For it talks about justice in the street and the intersection. I live in a culture that's got marvelous museums, beautiful music halls, marvelous concerts. And CBS says that 60% of American men and women don't dare go more than a block from their home in the metropolitan area after 5 o'clock in the afternoon. You want to tell me justice in the street isn't important? Please come. He said, I got a problem. I'm into psychology. And I've discovered that one of the problems of trouble and crisis is that people freeze up. He said, I'm a little self-conscious, Bishop. He said, what we need in this Bible is a little erotica. Try that with the United Methodist Council of Bishops. They believe it, but will they admit it to each other? He was dead right. The problem of a crisis is, I got hurt once and I'll be jiggered if I'm going to get hurt a second time. Oh, come on. Lover, open up. Let's go. I'm as proud as a peacock that we've got 5 wonderful erotic poems in the Old Testament. Somebody said, this is God in Israel? Maybe. Christ in the church? Maybe. Read the 4th chapter, preferably in the New English Bible, which was translated by an old don who had been holed up at Oxford for 40 years. Your neck, my beloved. Where did they ever get the idea that religious people couldn't be erotic? If we don't really deal with the erotic in the church, we are party to the selling of pornography in the drugstore. Your neck, like a Tower of David, on which are hung all sorts of bucklers. Oh, dear. Your teeth, like ewe lambs that had been down for a bath. Every one of them perfect. You know, it was a little difficult in pre-dental age to fall in love with somebody who had a mythic tooth. Do you love me? Yes, sweetie, I love you. I'm not making fun of anybody, you know that. You know that. What a magnificent idea it was. You see, I cannot live without it. Why, Jesus Christ is the most erotic person I've ever met. I long to be held by him. I long to put him and John together. I love baptisms because what we're doing is saying, here, Christ, a new one for your family. It pains me no end that the New Testament is taken away from Jesus' hero. What must have been incredibly wonderful relationships to a significant degree. Gotta have wisdom. I gotta have Job. We'll get on to that. Gotta have Ecclesiastes. I'd hate like Sam Hill to have a parish of Ecclesiasteses. But there are a few of them out there. And they're not dummies. They're educated. They've traveled. They've got a library full of books and a basement full of Mogan David. And they live. But they are bored stiff. I so much would like to hand a second Isaiah to Ecclesiastes. Except ye become a light. How about going to Hadassah in South Jerusalem, Ecclesiastes, and taking the hold of a little child's leg and helping him get healed? It never even occurs to him. I'm not down on Ecclesiastes. I sure wouldn't want to spend a lot of time with very many of them. Can you hear me? Well, I've just been reading a life of Willa Cather. She comes from the same province I do, Nebraska. One of her masterpieces was Death Comes to the Archbishop. Do you remember? It happens that the Archbishop of Santa Fe, a Frenchman in origins and a missionary in Santa Fe, was her idol. She said, I liked him for two reasons. Class, would you get this? That he was at once a connoisseur. He had a knowledge of an art and knew how to make discerning judgments. He was at once a connoisseur and a pioneer. That just about gets it for me. I'd like to be so much of a connoisseur that I would have the pizzazz to be an informed and responsible pioneer. I have to believe that Jesus of Nazareth was in the wisdom tradition because he was a connoisseur. And that made him a pioneer. I set the wisdom tradition, we'll get into it the next hour more seriously. Can you stand that painful thought? Please. A grace note. I have said to you before several things. I make no apology. This is my last flight in Florida. But a few years ago, they brought our oldest living alumnus back. He was 96. He'd given us a couple dollars. And for that, we will have a special convocation. Try us. They didn't know what to do with him when they got him to the school, so somebody said, why don't we go to chapel? When they got there, a very, very loose-tongued associate dean said, would you like to speak to the students? And the old man said, yes, and I thought, good heavens, he'll be longer than I am. So they draped him over the pulpit. And he looked at the students, and he said, I would like to thank my alma mater for setting me free without setting me adrift. And he sat down. Just about gets it, doesn't it? That's what I want the biblical tradition to do. Give us a foundation. Come on, you connoisseurs. Drink deeply and eat ravenously. Then you will be the pioneers in the wisdom tradition. I love the fourth grader who sent a note to her teacher. If you're happy inside, why don't you send a message to your face? I think if you will run the risk of being wise, you'll start smiling.